Yeah, I mean, it is kind of funny because it's like, hey, can you guys pay slightly more taxes for us protecting your interests? It's like, how about new country? It's like, oh. I mean, I guess that's okay.
Hello and welcome to The Buck Starts Here, the podcast that digs deep into the juicy stories, power plays, and wild twists that shape the presidencies of the United States. I'm Kyle, your casual history connoisseur, and I'm joined by Eric, our brilliant loose cannon economist who gets results, brings a wealth of knowledge, and the wildest historical facts to the table. This week we are on to Thomas Jefferson, and this is our first controversial legacy we get to dissect. And since we like to start with personal character, the next 45 minutes could get very interesting, to say the least.
Yeah, absolutely.
So I want to ask you how you want to handle this one. I also have some corrections from last week that we got to get to, so I don't know which order you want to do that in.
Let's do the corrections first. I always like the corrections.
Okay. All right. So last week we talked about the Mormon company, Deseret.
Yeah.
And I said the correction. I think I corrected it to Deseret. No, it's Deseret. And for the third time now, Laura has corrected us. Deseret is the proper way to pronounce that. Deseret Industries.
This is, I didn't think ever in my life there'd be a triple correction
to I know.
A failed state.
Well, I could have just gone back and fixed the original correction, but I kind of don't know. I feel absolutely. Like now you just got to leave it in there.
No, absolutely not. These people need to, you know, we're men of the people. They should see our weaknesses and flaws. That's all we're supposed to do.
Especially someone who grew up in the Mormon religion and does not recognize the Mormon company name. I cannot believe I've never come across that before.
I've never seen it pronounced. I've read about it. That's why I completely butchered how it's pronounced.
Well, I'll throw a T in there next time where you don't think it belongs.
Hey, as long as it's not an R.
Right, right. All right, Thomas Jefferson, how do you want to handle this one?
So I was speaking to Laura and Kyle in the pre-show. So as you know, listeners will know is that I hide all the information from the two people who actually make this podcast work. And what I do with every president. So Washington's obviously Adams was the easiest president to do since I grew up one street over from where he lived. Mm. And Washington, I mean, Washington's an interesting character because the beginning of his life, because of how he grew up, wasn't really known. And we kind of flew into that kind of, demigod status that Washington had. I won't say easier, but it made it a lot more direct. I mean, we know Adams's flaws, and Adams had a very, very famous miniseries. Like, it's like a hugely famous miniseries, one of the most popular historical books written by one of the most popular historical authors of the last, I guess, Dave McCall is probably one of the most influential history writers of the last 100 years, maybe more.
I don't know that I've come across him before.
Oh, yeah. So Dave McCall, he wrote like the Adams series that came into the book. That's probably way bigger for somebody from Quincy. So like, right. I don't, but like, I'd probably say like him, James Bradley, and Stephen Ambrose are probably like the three most popular history writers of the last like probably 100 years. So there's a lot of information where you could start off on, and then I mean, when we learn about the American Revolution, we learn about a lot of stuff that happened with those two gentlemen, and then we get into Jefferson, who is certainly a founding father, certainly one of the most influential founding fathers, one of the influential presidents, but the walking contradiction. The man who, at one point, wrote such vicious anti-slave language in the original copy of the Declaration of Independence that the Continental Congress removed it before they sent it to King George, but also inherited 30 slaves, and his dad died at 14, and when Jefferson passed away, he had 600. But Jefferson also wrote such aggressive anti-slave language in the original draft of the Declaration of Independence that the Continental Congress actually voted to remove it before they sent it to King George III. And on top of that, I mean, he was a strict constitutionalist who didn't believe the president should be able to buy land. He bought the largest piece of land in U.S. history. And
hold on a second. What did you say about the anti-slavery language? Didn't the U.K. already outlaw slavery at this point?
Yeah, and this is probably something to be fact-checked on here, but I believe they were already in the process of outlawing slavery in England itself, but there was still slave practice all throughout the British Empire at this point.
So he wrote something so aggressive that the country that was trying to unwind from it thought it was too much.
Well, the Continental Congress voted to not even include it in the Declaration of Independence.
They were afraid that this would offend them. Or something. Yeah. Okay.
That's a good way to word that, guy. I like that. So you know, one of the things that when going through this research and looking through, you know, Jefferson's life and, you know, drafting up, you know, we don't follow scripts on this show, but drafting up, you know, kind of the most important parts to make sure we cover on here, is that it's one contradiction after the other with him. And I think, you know, the lazy man psychologist would probably say that he's just a hypocrite.
Right.
Which is probably, I want to say that was my opinion before I started this. It certainly was a little bit, because I didn't like how he dealt with my boy John. But right. The more I came to appreciate the complexity of it, and I think a lot of our view on Jefferson comes, you know, from a historical standpoint, comes from that we elevated the founding fathers to these, like, ideas, you know, a viewpoint of ideas, right? That these were great men with, it was weird to challenge them as. You almost
deified them.
Exactly. That they possessed some sort of infallibility. And then as we matured as a nation, you know, a lot of the stuff those founding fathers did, especially somebody like Jefferson, really kicked the can down the road. And Jefferson wrote a lot about in his life. I mean, he published many books and long-form essays. And it's funny because he clearly knew this was going to be an issue. He saw the Civil War coming 60, 70, 80 years before it did. And I think these weren't men of, infallibility. These weren't philosophers, right? Mm-hmm. These were farmers, right? These were politicians. These were generals. They knew they weren't operating in a perfect world. And they tried to make the best decision they could, knowing the challenges. And to be honest, the things they couldn't cure in society. Mm-hmm. And then we look back to 300 years later and we go, why didn't they see that coming? Well, if it's choosing between being a unified nation or addressing the slave issue, which virtually nobody else in the world at this point had addressed anyways, well, you got to make a tough choice. And we view them right on these pedestals. These men didn't at the time. And I think over time we've shaped our view of Jefferson and we've come to accept that there is some hypocritical aspects of him. And I think personally, if you compare it to John Adams, it looks even more stark, even more extreme. But yeah, so we're going to cover, I know, like Kyle said, the first episode is usually talking about them as a person, trying, you know, make them into somebody we can relate to. And luckily, we have a good amount of information on Jefferson's early life, which we didn't really have with Washington and, you know, wasn't super interesting with Adams.
Why is that? Why do we have so much more information on Jefferson? Was it just a better family that he came from that?
So much money.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh my word. So much money he had. He was the 1% of the 1% in the colonies. he wasn't born with a silver spoon in his mouth. He was born with a gold spoon in his mouth. He is not right. Like, he's not a son of a farmer, son of a planter, who was gonna work his whole life. Oh no. That was not this man.
Speaking of Britain trying to abolish slavery, it was 1883 when they finally did abolish that. Thank you, Laura.
Ooh, that is late.
Yeah, that's after we did it.
What's newer, the telephone or slave-free England?
Right?
Yeah, I think the last country to outlaw slavery is East Timor. And I think that was like within our lifespan.
Was that like 2005?
Yeah, it was early enough to where it was a problem.
Could I have a smartphone, I think?
Yeah. Thomas Jefferson was the third president of the United States, and he was the walking contradiction. Born April 13th, 1743, in Shadwell, Virginia, Jefferson was a lawyer, a planter, and a revolutionary thinker who became one of the founding fathers' brightest stars, one of their most complicated. Jefferson burst onto the national stage as the guy who wrote the Declaration of Independence in 1776, serving as a poetic ode to liberty while conveniently sidestepping the whole owning human situation. He later became governor of Virginia, guiding the state through the chaos of the Revolutionary War, and served as George Washington's first Secretary of State, where he sparred with Hamilton over just about everything. Literally everything. It actually caused Jefferson to step down. By the time Jefferson snagged the presidency in 1801 at 57, he cemented his reputation as a champion of small government, low taxes, agrarian utopia, yeoman farmers' rule of land, and his presidency was a mixed bag of brilliant missteps. On one hand, he pulled off the Louisiana Purchase, doubling the size of the United States for a bargain price, sent out the Lewis and Clark expedition. On the other hand, the Embargo Act wasn't too great. Really damaged the economy. Jefferson's personal life only added to his mystique and controversy. Married to Martha, who died young, leaving him heartbroken and the sole parent of their surviving children. And then there was Sally Hemings, an enslaved woman at Monticello, with whom Jefferson likely fathered several children. His messy legacy, historians are still unpacking. And after retiring in 1809 and retreating to Monticello, where he dabbled in architecture, science, and the founding of the University of Virginia, his life finally came to an end on July 4th, 1826, fittingly on the 50th anniversary of the signing of the Declaration of Independence.
And a couple hours before John Adams passed away.
His last thing was making John Adams incorrect, which is probably one of his favorite things. I gotta imagine when Adams got to heaven, he probably was like, you had to make me wrong in my last statement.
Right.
No, so Mr. Kyle, where do you want to begin on this?
Oh my gosh. Okay. Well, you kind of talked a little bit about his beginnings. Like, where did the family money come from? Like, how did the family gain notoriety? Why was he in position to be where he was at the time?
Yeah. So his parents, Peter and Jane Jefferson. His dad was a successful planter, and for a running theme on the show, a surveyor.
Okay. Apparently those were high demand.
High demand back then. Yeah. Gotta respect it. So there's a lot of, not like contemporary, again, like I always struggle because I always want to say contemporary pieces, but these pieces written in like the late 1700s, early 1800s, which was obviously well after Peter Jefferson passed away. So they're not, just because something's old doesn't make it contemporary. That's one of those big things in history and economics we talk a lot about. For some reason, a lot of like primary sources will remark on his physical strength. Like Peter Jefferson was like apparently just swole. Imagine being so jacked people write about it like hundreds of years afterwards.
Oh, dude, but you know, he's the guy who's inviting people over to his house and then like bending iron bars in front of him. Like, they're writing about it because he's making sure they know about it.
I like that. I like that a lot. Yeah, no, okay. That's definitely what it was. He wanted to be known. It's kind of like when we were talking about, you know, people getting painted in portraits, and it was like, oh, you made them look nice, right? You don't make the guy who's paying you a year's wage look bad.
He's the one who took his shirt off before he did it. He's the modern day Instagram.
wait till we get to Theodore Roosevelt. We'll talk about it a little bit. Hilarious piece of strengths.
Oh yeah, that's right.
He had a lazy eye because he got in a boxing match with like a professional boxer at.
Did he try to wrestle a bear too at some point?
Probably. That sounds very reasonable for Theodore Roosevelt. So a lot of their success, a lot of the family money came originally from Jane. So Jane was from like the most prominent family in pretty much in all of the colonial Virginia, but also from England itself that emigrated over. So he was born with a gold spoon in his mouth, if we're being honest. Like, he had two incredibly affluent parents. His father passed away young, and I know one of the things we often talk about is making sure we understand, like, you know, these people are humans, right? Like, nobody wants to lose their dad at 14. His dad left him 5,000 acres with 30 slaves. I mean, they left him an economic juggernaut. And as we mentioned in the reading, that Shadwell was the plantation he grew up on. Mm-hmm. It's near modern day Charlottesville, Virginia, just to give people kind of an idea of where it is. Now, Peter Jefferson, as he's a surveyor planter, he was also, he dabbled in cartography, just used to make maps.
Right.
Thought that was interesting. I like maps. I included that.
That sounds like a good, like a useful hobby. Like if you liked making maps, then you should probably come to the New World.
Yeah, right. Even today, geography is one of like the has one of the highest employment rates of
really?
Like any degree. Jane Jefferson's mom, she was from the Randolph family. Like I said, one of the most elite families in all Virginia. Basically, like nobody worked in the family; it was all planters and plantation owners.
Another interesting commonality I'm starting to notice is it seems like a lot of the people who had money got it from the women that they married.
Yeah.
The exception of maybe Adams.
Abigail.
Yeah. Right.
And Jane so far. So, yeah, you're right. Key to success is having a mom who's smart with money and from an affluent family. Who would have thunk it? So, Jefferson was the third of 10 children. So, he had big family, just like a lot of the founding fathers had. What I think is kind of cool is that whole like area he grew up in, that Albemarle County.
Mm-hmm.
I believe it's named after, they named it after where his mom's from, which I gotta believe that's a different level of social hierarchy and affluency if you come from England and they name where you move to after where you, like, you have the power to just be like, I want to start a new place. Like, if I just moved, like, to, I don't know, California, and it's like New Quincy, it's like, oh, that's
right.
She has some sway to do that. But yeah, so and Shadwell, just set the scene. Shadwell is in the Blue Ridge Mountains, just to give you like an idea of where he grew up. So
that's gorgeous, dude.
Yeah, it really is. It's literally looks like my wife's from that area, and it looks like a painting when you're driving. You're like, wow, right. That is unbelievable. So from a young age, like, his parents knew that Jefferson was going to be this, was going to be an aristocrat. And so they start educating very young. Unlike the other founding fathers, where education was certainly a focus, but they were still came from upper, you know, I'd say like upper middle class. I would argue that George Washington didn't come from the upper middle class. I would argue that George Washington was probably better defined as working class if we had to equate it to modern standards. John Adams came from a prominent, well, from an educated family. I don't want to say overly well-educated or overly prominent, but he came from a well-established family. It wasn't until he married Abigail that he really saw a social increase.
Right.
Jefferson's the opposite. Jefferson's family, he was basically told from a young age, his job is to be, an intelligent, well-rounded individual who needs to be able to have managerial experience to be able to run the plantation when his dad died. But he was taught the Greeks. He was taught Latin history.
It's a true Renaissance man.
True Renaissance man. One of the terms you may hear us say throughout like this dialogue, because it was very prominent in Jefferson's life. And if somebody like gets really interested and goes back and wants to read more about Jefferson's life, there's something called natural philosophy that's just science. That's what we would call just like a science. I wouldn't even say biology. We just call it science today.
Yeah.
Back then, they called it natural philosophy. So he does that up to the age of like 14. He had this really influential guy in his life, Dr. William Small. This is a cool thing about Jefferson. Like, we know so much about him. Like, just William Small is like a famous Scot. Mm-hmm. Like, he was a pure Renaissance man. He was a professor. He was, and Jefferson met him while he was at Williams and Mary's College, which that's where Jefferson went to. Williams and Mary's is a public college, which I always find to be like a random trivia fact. I think that's cool. So Dr. Small super influenced Jefferson's life, right? A huge influence. He was like his personal mentor. He was his personal tutor. And I think it's really interesting because the person who influenced Jefferson was huge on mathematics and natural philosophy. And what's funny to think about this time is that a classical education didn't really cover mathematics, especially not mathematics in the way we think of today. I mean, calculus is like 100 years, not even 100 years old at this time.
Your biggest need for mathematics at that point is just for accounting practices, right?
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, I would be very curious to see, maybe surveying.
I was going to say a surveyor probably have a pretty good grasp of it.
Yeah.
At least naturally, you would think, or geometry.
Yeah, that's a good point. Cartography, you probably, Mercator projections probably use it.
Yeah.
This is a side note I was not prepared on. Oh, no, right? So what becomes really influential is that if you think of Adams, or a lot of the founding fathers, but particularly think of Adams and Washington that we've talked about so far, a lot of their influence comes from traditional British Enlightenment. That certainly had an impact on Jefferson, but it wasn't actually his background, because Dr. William Small was somebody who was consumed by the Scottish Enlightenment. And the Scottish Enlightenment is more focused on like reason and empirical evidence. Don't get me wrong. So, we just step back a little bit. When you talk about the breakup, and this is very, very broad, but you talk about breakup of European philosophy at the time, you had the continental philosophies, which focus a lot more on like logic and rationalism and reason. And then you had British style philosophy, which was, think like Francis Bacon, which was empirical evidence. They totally shared ideas and crossed. Anybody who thinks it was one on one side, one on the other, that's just a simplistic view of it. But Scottish Enlightenment was markedly different than your British Enlightenment because of that proportionally more focus on reason.
So it's less of like scientific method, like Newton developed, and more of like the old Greek way of doing it, where you just kind of thought it out. You did a lot of thought experiments like that.
Yeah, like logos, pathos, ethos, stuff like that. Yeah,
gotcha.
Which you'll see maybe that's where some of his, I don't want to keep using the word hypocrisy, but where some of his rationalism begins to play out in his policymaking, because I mean, there's a famous I forget which philosopher said it, but there's a critique of rationalism where a man could rationalize the prick of his finger to the destruction of the world. Yeah. Maybe that rationalism bleeds into a little bit of all men are created equal. Don't go to my farm.
Right.
So throughout his adolescence and childhood, he's getting tutored. He's getting all this amazing education. One of the coolest things is that, and I don't mean to like overly go on small, but I just think it's really important, like, to understand the man who made Jefferson who he was, especially in intellectual capacity. Was Dr. Small was like kind of really known for this super progressive teaching method of like wanting students to be curious about what they're learning instead of like
that's progressive.
You sit there and have rote learning.
Right.
And Jefferson even said that it was the most formative experience and relationship he had in his entire life.
Basically just encouraging you to study what you find interesting.
Yeah, and to adapt a more tactile learning methodology.
Oh, and surprising that that works.
Yeah, who would ever guess that? I think I don't want to compare it to Montessori style schools, because I think there's more complexity in between like what makes a school environment a school environment. But it probably is not a bad metaphor for almost like a Montessori type school, but back in the 1760s.
I'm nodding like I know what you're talking about.
Oh, do you guys not have Montessori schools?
I don't know what you're talking about.
Oh, it's kind of cool. Google it sometime. It's kind of cool. It's like kids learn through like tactile and active play. It's like for younger kids. I'm a fan.
I guess we do have in Arizona. All right. Never mind. Another thing I've never run across.
Kyle's like, this is why we should share notes before we do this. Right. So, yeah, and to end on the relationship between Dr. Small and Jefferson is that there's a lot of, outside of Jefferson, there's a lot of people who point at Dr. Small and say he was a bridge between Scottish Enlightenment and the American intellectual movement, the Philosophes movement of the late 1700s. Cool people you learn about as you go through this.
So you're taking us up to, that was 14. At what point does, like, the revolution actually start here?
So this is where it gets interesting. So he gets... The House of Burgess, he gets appointed to. So his father dies in 1757,
and he kind of
ends his formal schooling. He ends his formal schooling at about 21 years old, because Dr. Small goes back to Scotland. So that's 1764. So about 5 years passes. He practices law for about 5 years. He mostly represents. It's like land disputes and stuff like that. It's nothing overly interesting. He works under this guy, George Wythe, who's actually this like hugely influential attorney in Virginia, who is known for like more like, I don't want to say constitutional law because that didn't exist at the time, but think more like public or policy law, not like, hey, figure out like who owns this property. But one of my favorite things about Jefferson during this time period is he's like, essentially like the legal side of a debt collector. I like this idea of, you know, Thomas Jefferson, who was the same height as George Washington, 6'2", so big guy for that time period. He had strawberry blonde hair that he used to wear as a ponytail when he was a younger man, just debt collecting. So just like that. They're people, you do weird jobs when you're younger, like, right?
Right. Well, it's 6'2", you're probably, debt collector's probably a pretty fitting role.
Oh, Kyle, that's a good point. I wonder if he physically collected the debt. He wasn't just doing the legal for it. He just shows up with like an axe.
Maybe you had to be a strong lawyer because you had to do it all. He's got to go actually serve the papers.
It's like Saul. I like that.
Right.
So Jefferson was always very politically connected his whole life, even as a young man.
Yeah, it makes sense. Being that wealthy, you're going to have your fingers in a lot of pots.
Oh, yeah. He ended up hanging out with the governor when he was like 12, 13 years old. He met him and stayed close with him during his time in there. But to answer your question, he joins the House of Burgess in 1769. So there's 5 years of kind of practicing law. He was elected. So he's 26 years old. He gets elected to the House of Burgess.
What's the House of Burgess? Is this something that's UK, or is this something that we've set up?
Kind of. So it's essentially the British House of Commons. Oh, sorry, Virginia's House of Commons. So think very, very parliamentary.
So it's kind of like you not giving us a right to sit at the table. representation was kind of a big deal, right? So they're not letting them be represented in England, so they just decided to start one here, maybe, to see if they can get that takeoff.
Yeah, I think like they started it, and the Brits were like, we're more okay with this, because you get to play pretend. It's like you have the little kid the fake phone.
Right, right. Yeah, exactly. the little lawnmower that...
I like that one. So he joins up, and we start to see some other... I mean, I'm sure there's a lot of people who are familiar with American Revolutionary history here. You start to see some famous names around, like Patrick Henry. So he was part of the House of Burgess. So, I want to make sure I'm pronouncing it right, because my accent's killing me. Burgesses. All right. I know we'll get flack from that. I don't want to get a correction early next time.
It's not the bourgeois.
No. he's not hanging out with Patrick Henry and Richard Henry Lee. And they're just, like, super, like, they don't want to be part of Britain anymore. They want to have a revolution. They want to secede from Britain. And I always think it's kind of funny, because the first thing they show up, and the first thing they do, they're like, yo, let's just leave. Everybody's like, no, this is supposed to be a parliamentary procedure. We're supposed to see if we can reconcile. And he's like, oh, no, we should just leave. We should just, let's go form our own country.
And out of the opposite Jefferson.
Pops up. Which is ironic that the state of Jefferson was also fiercely, I believe it was supposed to be a free state. So that's kind of funny. Oh. All right, so he did two major things when he was in the House of Burgesses. One of them's really interesting. So he was a huge advocate of religious freedom.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, very big, very big advocate. And also pushed, it was kind of the first push of the separation of church and state. And where the term separation of church and state comes from, it's actually not from the U.S. Constitution.
Right.
That's like one of those, like, misbeliefs.
It's like one of those four words in there, right? In like the preamble or something like that.
No, so the First Amendment, it's freedom from established religion, which refers to when Henry VIII, like, forced everybody to basically be Anglican.
Because he wanted a divorce, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, so you get a divorce, that's literally, he got essentially what's the Medal of Honor from the Catholic faith, the defender of the church, and there was like, yo, I want a new wife, and the Pope's like, no, and he's like, I'm fine in my own religion. Bizarre. But the term separation of church and state actually comes from a letter, and I believe it's 1808, between Thomas Jefferson and the Danbury Baptist Church in Connecticut, where he talks about separation of church and state.
Okay. I didn't realize that was Jefferson.
I once bet an English teacher in college about that, because she said it's in the Constitution. I was like, I will give you $100 if you look that up. And she looked it up, and she's like, oh, it's not there? And I was like, boom.
Yeah.
And I realized, as an instructor now, if I had a student fact-check me for a $100 bet in a class, I'd throw them out. I should have been thrown out of that class. I'm sorry. She's listening. I'm just sorry. That's on me. You were
right.
But kind of talking about the contradictions of Jefferson, the other big thing he passed... were these laws that restricted concentration of land ownership.
Mm-hmm.
So at that time, there was these laws basically saying that all the land would get passed on to like the old, essentially like the oldest heir of the family.
Right.
And it concentrated wealth in land ownership, which is essentially wealth at the time, if we're being honest. I mean, there was a stock exchange.
That's how he got his wealth.
Yeah. And actually passed laws and fought against the establishment of those laws. So, walking contradiction, he got all his money from this, and he's the same guy trying to reduce it.
God, he almost sounds like a person that kind of hated himself.
Yeah, there's probably a little bit of that, dude.
Right?
Because what we're going to talk about throughout this is that he was in debt pretty much his entire life.
Right. As wealthy as everything was, one of the things we talked about when we got to Adams was that was the only founding father's estate survived. And I didn't realize that Jefferson was that affluent. So it must have been quite a fall.
Yeah, he was just in debt his entire life. Horrible money management. That's part of the reason he never freed slaves. Part of the reason he made some decisions he did.
Probably why he accumulated them.
Yeah, like you were kind of honest. You're right.
Yeah.
I problematically so, and we'll get more into this, is that he had a very paternalistic view of slavery, which is, obviously very horribly racist, but...
Yeah.
Yeah, and... But then wrote all men are created equal.
You can't
marry those two ideas. They're mutually exclusive.
Yeah.
So as we lead up to the Declaration of Independence, that was not Jefferson's first foray into writing nationally read papers. After the Coercive Acts were passed in 1774. So the Coercive Acts were basically like the Brits passed the Stamp and Townshend Act to raise money after the Seven Years' War, right? And then Boston was like, we're going to throw all your tea into the water. Screw you.
Right.
And then, like, you know, caused a riot that resulted in 5 colonial deaths. Oh, that we covered under Adams. So it was covered in the previous series. They passed these things called Coercive Acts of 1774. And these are kind of like not talked a lot about because it bleeds. Literally, they're passed in 1774. Lexington and Concord, 1775. Like, war goes off immediately.
Right.
But Jefferson, being you know, probably still boys with Adams at this point, he authors a very prominent pamphlet called A Summary View of the Rights of British America. And it kind of lays out the rationale for how they should be treated. Now, again, this is before the Lexington Concord, So there hasn't been really any, like, horrible bloodshed besides the Boston Massacre, which, again, we all know how that went through the Adams series.
Five people. Massacre seems a bit of a hyperbole in that situation.
Are you telling me Bostonians are fond of hyperbole?
Yes.
Are you? That's the hardest thing my wife had when she moved up here, is that everything's like, it's taking 4 hours to drive everywhere. It's like, it was 25 minutes. I don't know why you're young. Yeah, I mean, it is kind of funny because it's like, hey, can you guys pay slightly more taxes for us protecting your interests? It's like, how about new country? It's like, oh. I mean, I guess that's okay. So it really falls down into 5 points, and I'll run through them real quick. Because remember natural science, natural rights, talks about that a lot.
He says,
basically, British America should be able to govern itself or be independent. He critiques all the British policies, taxation with recommendation, the trade restrictions we had with certain countries. He straight up just is like, there shouldn't be a king. It's stupid you guys have a king. He doesn't say that verbatim, but it's as close to that as you're going to get.
And see why he liked France so much then.
It was very funny. It's very funny because I read a fair amount of it. And he gets progressively angrier as you get through it. So
Is the writing getting worse?
maybe Kyle. Like, I would love to actually see what it handwritten looks like.
Right.
He gets to a certain point and he's just like, you know what? We shouldn't even have British at all. The British authority shouldn't be here at all. Like, we'll pay you taxes, but you should have no judges, no internal controls. Like, you should just leave us alone.
So he started out with this paper of this is how we could work together. These are the rights we should have. You know what? You talked me out of it. We're leaving.
And he ends it with like the last couple stanzas are basically like, you know, let's call for unity. We are one country, and we should resist the British rule. And I love that he went from we should be autonomous and self-governed to like, king shouldn't exist. Leave us alone. We should fight you. I'm like, whoa, dude. But yeah, it was hugely influential.
Gotcha.
So I was going to cover like some of his children.
I think we kind of have to go there.
So Thomas Jefferson, he had 2 kids with his wife, Martha Skelton. So Martin Skelton, she died really young. She died at like 26, 27. The first one, Martha, who went by Patsy, you'll hear more from her because she became like, she was basically like the first lady-ish. She filled the first lady role for Jefferson when he became president. Mm-hmm. She was like super well-educated. She was kind of awesome, if I'm being honest with you. Like she was kind of Abigail Adams-y. And then the other one, talk about Abigail Adams. This is the one who Abigail famously took care of when she went to England, which is Polly. Mary's her real name. She was the second surviving daughter, but what's kind of sad is that Jefferson and Martha had 6 kids together, and only 2 survived to adulthood. It was a horrible time.
I mean, that was kind of common. Survival rate was, what, 30-40% of childbirth?
There's an interesting stat that if you remove people who passed away before age 5, the average life expectancy in the world
has not changed much.
Yeah. It's like literally only started changing the last like 100 years.
Yeah, if you made it to your mid-20s, I think it was pretty likely that you'd make it to like 50.
Very, very, very sad. And he had 6 kids with his slave, Sally Hemings, that we mentioned in the beginning. And this is obviously, a very complicated topic. And, you know, this isn't really the show that dives into the sociological aspect of this. I think I know I can't do that. I know Kyle would be better at me than doing this, but still probably wouldn't be.
Yeah, that's the only thing I can really want to say about that is I don't think it's very difficult to infer the type of character of a person who goes and bothers children with their slaves.
Yeah, it's complicated.
Yeah.
So, but Sally Hemings, she was, they it even feels weird to say they had six kids together, as if it was like some mutual, like, we're going to have kids together.
Right.
But I'll put it three. Thomas Jefferson fathered six kids with her, and yeah, he was not a good father to them. No. Like, he wasn't. Now, what's interesting from a historical perspective, and I mentioned it a little earlier, that, you know, you read, like, 1970s, you read, this would be contemporary sources. It was always speculated, but actually in the late 90s, it was confirmed through DNA testing that these were his kids. Which I think is kind of interesting when you read, like, papers from, like, the 1970s that just heavily inferred it.
Right.
And one thing, Kyle made a point to bring this up in the pre-show when him and I were talking, but the Monticello estate deserves a lot of credit for how open they are with this history.
I mean,
they are good historians. They're good Americans who talk about this horrible stuff because it should be talked about. This should absolutely be discussed. So, you know, they had six kids. Two of them passed away young. He had Harriet Hemings. And then the other child died so young, they never named him. But here's where it gets really why in some previous episodes I talked about my difficulty with Jefferson.
Yeah.
So he had the four kids who survived, Beverly and Harriet. And yes, just in case anybody's listening, the child that passed away when she was two, they renamed a child born about a few years later Harriet also.
Yeah.
Which is weird. And I also want to make a timeline clear here. This is happening while he's president.
Right.
So three of these kids are born while he's president. 1801, 1805, 1808. So Beverly and Harriet, they were both Harriet who survived, obviously. The term that's used here is they passed as white. So when they were old enough, they were allowed to leave the Monticello estate.
They had light enough skin tone to basically what you're saying, yeah.
Yeah, correct. And what's interesting, though, is, and for what it's worth, but a lot of historians note that Jefferson, you know, he gave special treatment to his slave children. He educated them, made sure they were literate. And I just want to start off with, if any sentence starts with special treatment to slave children, you're not a good person.
Like, no.
That's not a good situation.
Slave and child are used to describe the same child. Your child.
Your?
Yeah. Like,
but Madison and Esten, who is the last two children he had with Sally Hemings, they did not pass as white. And they were never freed. Jefferson never freed them. But here's the thing.
They were freed.
You get some revisionists. They were eventually. They?
Yeah.
Yes. You get some revisionary historians, some Jefferson apologists who will say, no, he freed his slave children. I'm like, okay, you're already arguing from, you know, you're fighting that battle from the valley if you're trying to argue about his, you know, his personal life and being a good person. If you're saying, correction, he did free them after he died. That's, you're so crappy.
Right.
Yeah. It was Patsy. Martha freed them.
Yeah.
Like, she had inherited her father's estate. Was like, oh, what the heck? My half-siblings? Like, I don't know how much she knew about it, but she's like, what's going on here? And she immediately freed them.
God for the women of the founding, or revolutionary period, yeah, right?
Yeah, the founding mothers, definitely good track record. Like, generally,
yes.
Besides Martha, I like Martha, don't get me wrong, but sending essentially the National Guard to hunt down your favorite slave, dressmaking slave, was not a bright point in early Republic's history.
No.
But Abigail, awesome.
Abigail was amazing, yes.
I'm a very big fan of Abby. obviously, Patsy seems like she's down. I like her. I'm a fan. So, yeah, Sally died in, I don't want to use the word captivity, but she died in slavery, because it's a prisoner system. It really is.
Yeah. Regardless of what type is practiced, which I think you kind of talked about the differences in the first episode we did.
No, and again, I don't want to sound like this guy, but it makes me, you could probably see why I very much like Adams.
Yeah, he was the only one that seemed to have like a real, like he lived what he said. He said what he believed, and he believed what he said. He walked the walk. Like all of his actions reinforced your belief in him and his character.
Yeah, I mean, and he was fine being hated for it. And I don't,
yeah,
like, Jefferson was described as charismatic, but very, very introverted, very, I don't want to use the word shy, because he was a great orator. Like, he could speak, but very reserved, very internalized. I think he wanted to be liked. I really think, and I guess, you know, people are people, right? You grow up being told you're better than everybody else. You grow up in this aristocratic family. You grow up with slaves.
Losing your dad, let's not discount like how much that affects a child too.
Right.
Especially a boy, losing your father is kind of a big deal, yeah.
Yeah. It, you know, we're not here to judge how it was left or right. You know, we're here to basically, you know, this is a podcast that talks about presidential history and well, eventually the economics of this. Jefferson right. Jefferson didn't have that much influence on the economy when he was 26. Right. Wait till we get to the Embargo Act. That's gonna be a fun one. Oh my god. Talk about having, you think with all that education you would have picked up, you know, Adam Smith's A Wealth of Nations and gone from there. But
you know, the crazy thing that it keeps blowing my mind thinking about it, all this stuff is happening during like the Enlightenment period over in Europe. Okay. Like thinking of like Isaac Newton, Galileo, and all that stuff happening at the same time. I never connected the two as happening concurrently. It's like two different worlds almost.
Yeah, I mean, all the founding fathers were, particularly Jefferson, was very influenced by Thomas Paine and John Locke. He was very influenced by that. I like John Locke.
He's from Lost, like, right?
Yeah. No. From Lost. I think of the two treaties on government, but yeah, no, also. Yeah.
Anyway, I think we've probably got to the end of this controversial Jefferson episode one. Join us next week when we start picking apart the policies that define Jefferson's presidency, like the aforementioned Embargo Act that Eric's been just raring to get going on.
Really want to go on that one.
So in the meantime, what are your thoughts on Jefferson? Does he deserve his spot immortalized on a mountain, or would you swap him out for somebody else? You can email us at buckstartsherepodcast@gmail.com, or you can visit the website at buckstartsherepodcast.com to stay up to date, and we will see you all next week.